Hello, everyone, and welcome to Classic Jazz Talk. This interview is presented by Jazz Con Class Radio and brought to you by BlogTalkRadio.com. My name is Jose Reyes, and I will be your host. And along with Noel Cohen, he will be my co-host. Today's interview will be with Helene Lafaro Fernandez, and we'll totally concentrate on her book, Jade Visions. We will also be joined by jazz bassist Phil Palombi, who had a big contribution on this book and who will make it much easier to understand any musical / technical translations that we will need. If you are listening to this show right now and are interested in calling to convey a thought and or ask a question, please call in. The number is 646-716-8540. Again, the call-in number is 646-716-8540. Okay. I'm going to start by introducing everyone, starting with Noel Cohen, and he will be my co-host. Hello, Noel.
Yeah, hi, Jose.
Hi.
Pleasure to be here.
Yes, you're going to be co-hosting the show with me. I also have on the line Helene Lafaro Fernandez, the author of the book. This book, the interview is on her book, Jade Visions. Hello, Helene.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Okay, how are you doing? And we also have on the line Phil Palombi. Hello, Phil.
Hey, nice to see everybody, sort of.
Okay. All right. That's the introduction I set up now. Let's start with Helene. Hello, Helene. Can you give us an introduction to the book that you wrote here, Jade Visions?
Well, Jade Visions is a book I started working on in 2005, sort of at the behest of two people. One was Madeline Crouch of the International Society of Bassists, who kept telling me there really needed to be a book about Scotty. And another is Chuck Ralston, who is actually someone from our hometown, Geneva, New York, who had developed a really big interest in Scotty because his dad was a drummer in Geneva, as a matter of fact, president of the local musicians union. And he and my dad had done some jamming at Scotty when he was still playing saxophone. And so Chuck had developed a really deep interest in Scotty and followed his career. And if you're familiar with my book, he did one terrific job doing the discography in the book. So I kind of got roped into doing it, and I had a lot of trepidation at first because Scotty really enjoyed being an enigma. And I wondered whether I should really get into personal things about that. But I think I kind of got tired of saying no, 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 and succumbed. So that's kind of the roots of the book.
Okay. The book is not only an autobiography, but it also has dedicated parts, chapters on, as a matter of fact, Phil. You have a chapter on the book itself also, right?
Yes, I was very honored when Helene asked me to contribute to the book. And I transcribed all of Scotty's solos from the Vanguard session. And I was just asked to maybe talk a little about, the technical aspects of what he was doing and, how he soloed and just some things I learned about from that experience.
Okay. I'm sorry, Phil, I didn't. Can you give us a little intro of, because you're a current musician right now, a bass musician, jazz musician. And can you give us a little background of yourself, please?
Sure. I'm a jazz bassist living here in New York City. I'm originally from Youngstown, Ohio. my first jazz records, the first two records I ever bought when I started college. I didn't get into jazz until I was in college. I started late also, like Scotty. And it just so happened that the first two jazz records I ever bought were the Walter W. and Sunday to Vanguard. And man, the sound of those records just hooked me for, you know, Scott and the Bill Evans Trio immediately. Then, you know, after college, went on the road with Buddy Morrow, who I always thought was funny. Actually, was that was Scotty's first road gig as well. Not that I was chasing Scotty through history, but just amazing that, you know, decades later, my first road gig was with the same trombone player that Scotty started with. And, you know, Buddy told me some great stories. And I was happy, actually, that I was able to hook Buddy and Helene up for Helene's great book, you know, because he had a lot of really nice things to say about Scotty. He lit up Scott. So then after that, we'll have Maynard Ferguson and moved to New York and just been living in here since 1997.
Nice. That's nice. Noel, you have any questions for?
Yeah, let me ask Helene. You know, when I read the book, I knew that Scott LaFaro was very important as a bass, very innovative, but I didn't realize just how important he was until I read the book. And so I'm wondering, were you surprised as you got into the process of interviewing people and doing research and so forth? Were you, in fact, also surprised by some of the things that people were telling you about how significant his contributions were?
Oh, yeah, I was surprised early on. Shortly after he died, there'd be people who would contact me. But as the years passed, more and more people were contacting me. I'd find people on my doorstep from Australia that they had to seek out where Scotty was or his relatives were and things of that sort. And, over the years, the interest kept growing. And, you know, I've been told it's because kind of people expected new things. You know, he broke some ground and new things would come soon after. And the more and more years that passed, got up to 50 years. And even though there are lots and lots of great players, I guess it was the opinion that there had not, you know, most of this work was based on a lot that Scotty had done. And so I was constantly blown out of the water. People say, even classical bassists said they realized they could be a soloist after hearing Scotty. Mm-hmm. And it continues today that I'm totally, you know, blown away by how many people all over the world. I still today get, you know, phone calls and emails from people everywhere, and his popularity seems to only increase. The book, besides having two hardback printings here, it went into paperback, and it's also published in Japan in Japanese. And there's a club in Japan named Club Scott LaFaro. And this is, some 50, 60 years after he passed away. This is kind of a phenomenon.
Let me ask Phil. Phil, what, when you first started to listen to Scott LaFaro, what effect did it have on you?
As a musician, well, you know, when I first heard him, I wasn't much of a musician yet. You know, I just started as a rock bass player. Had a lot of drive, but not a lot of knowledge, certainly no knowledge of jazz. But when I heard these records, they were just beautiful. He played all the right stuff at the right time. And it, like, the technical aspect of it didn't even hit me. You know, it just sounded like what he was playing within the trio, and the trio as a whole just caught my ear. You know, those Vanguard records are very special, too. Just the captured sound quality is just so magical. You can really hear the inside of the Vanguard. I love that you could hear there's somebody, like, sitting in the front row, maybe one row back with a cold. You hear a sneeze. A woman, you hear a sneeze occasionally. You hear glasses clinking. You hear all this air around this trio that had been playing together so much that it was just like one organism. So I didn't even notice that what he was doing was actually hard on a bass to achieve from a technical standpoint. So I think that worked in my favor, but I guess the way it affected me was, okay, well, that's the bar. You know, that's what I'm expected to do. You know, I didn't realize at the time that that was something, you know, that not too many people were really going for at the time. And it's, you know, to this day, I don't even know that. Like, there's technical players, people doing technical things on the instrument that are way more technically advanced than what Scotty was doing. You know, if to get nitpicky about it, you know, there's people that do two-handed tapping on the upright bass and are playing chords and all this stuff.
I love that.
But yeah, it's amazing, but, you know, it all comes down to the music. And Scott really, really dug into the music, you know.
And also, if I'm not mistaken, it opened up the composing, right? He composed a lot of music, and it kind of gave the bassist an opportunity to compose more.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a musician, so
he only actually composed two pieces.
Two. I'm sorry. Okay, but I'm sure when he was. He helped compose a lot of other songs, too.
He had been doing a lot of composing in the last year, but a lot of it, one quite interestingly, he had been talking to Jerome Robbins and was interested in doing something with the bass and ballet. I think I mentioned that in the book, that's something that no one kind of expected.
I find the interesting thing about Scott's, even though that only two you know, compositions have been recorded, the forms on this composition are not in the bebop tradition. The chordal movement is very irregular, but the people he was playing with at the time, like Don Freeman and Booker Little, those guys at that moment in the 60s, 61, I play with Don Freeman quite a bit, and I always play Don's original compositions. And Don will have, normally in jazz and bebop, you know, it's all 8 bars, 4 bar, 8 bar, 16 bar, 32 bar phrasing. You know, playing with Don Freeman, a lot of his stuff is 7 bar phrasing, 9 bar, phrasing, 13 bars. And then, you know, transcribing, you know, Glorious Steps, for instance, you know, it's 5, 5, and 10, you know, which is irregular. And then we just did a tribute to Booker Little with Don Freeman. And Booker's music is also all irregular phrases. So Scott was part of this vanguard movement that was changing. Yeah, I think he was right there at the beginning, I think, of everybody that was starting to kind of break down the mold of traditional bebop and composition form. You know, Wayne Shorter as well. You know, Wayne at that point is starting to write, you know, different phrasing, you know, break out of bebop phrasing and stuff. So who knows, you know, where Scott would have taken that.
So just to follow up on that, do you think that had he lived, he wouldn't have... He might have gone with the more outside people as the 1960s progressed. Do you think he would have gone in that direction? Because what impresses me about him, the first thing I heard when I heard Scott LaFaro on records was time. I mean, the time was just so solid, you know, in the rhythm section. I mean, that was phenomenal. But you think he might have gone in a more outside direction then?
Well, Helene could probably speak more to maybe what his career ambitions were, or music selection, what he's listening to. And from my observations of, you know, recordings and that, I think he would have probably, I don't think he would have gone as far out as Ornette, you know, although he was playing with Ornette, so who knows. But compositionally, I think he liked having some structure, because structure then gives you the ability to play even more melodically over top of it. Sometimes structure can be even more fun than playing free, because you have a basis to where then you could really make a statement within a group, especially as the bass player. But I think he'd have been more like Don Freeman, you know, who, or in Booker Little even, who they have these structured tunes, but then they will have elements of free improvisation. You know, Don's written stuff where it's like he played a tune and then it stops and everybody free improvs, you know, over nothing set for a certain amount of time, and then comes back into a tune. So I think he would have definitely gone that route, at least. You know, who knows how much farther out he would have gone.
And could I ask, I guess, can we agree that perhaps the first modern jazz bassist that really started to play solos the way a horn player would have been Oscar Pettiford? Do we agree on that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, I know that that was one of the people he was listening to early on. My dad had introduced him to Oscar Pettiford, and at home, that's he was one of the major people that he was listening to.
Okay,
and,
interesting.
Right, right. And
I'm sorry.
Know, and then you know after that, of course, he was really into Duke Ellington, and you know had listened to some Jimmy Blanton, but you know beyond that, you know until he came out here, he Red Mitchell kind of took him under his wing, but those are really, you know, pretty much it as I remember and things. But, I mean, he was a real big fan of Dragonetti. And I know he, you know, played all sorts of classical things, listening to all the things that Dragonetti had written. And I think he had a book about Dragonetti had some, you know, books about the bass that came through that he was also into. So that's pretty much what I know about that facet of things.
But let me ask Phil, maybe you can explain to us, so how did Scott take things beyond Oscar Pettiford? Let me put it that way.
Well, Oscar was the pioneer who was bringing the bass to the forefront of an ensemble. And so one way Oscar did it was to double track cello. He had a cello and tune it in fourths. And it's, you know, the register's higher. And I think rather for Scott, rather than going back and going to cello route, like, well, you know, Oscar Pettiford was, I believe, credited as the first person to do that. And then everybody from, you know, Ron Carter to Sam Jones and Doug Watkins and everybody, Ray Brown also did that as well. But with Scott, I don't know, just within the piano trio, within, you know, it was the perfect combination. It could have never happened without Bill Evans and Paul Motion. That they, the way they played together, rather than have to get a cello to be heard, you know, get up, a, you know, make a statement like that, he was able to, they really gave him space to explore. And that combined with Scott went out to, you know, met Sam Kolsky, and Sam set the bass action, the action on the instrument lower than anybody else was doing at the time. And so rather than have to play a cello where you could play all these fast lines and, you know, that are up higher, Scott, with lower action, was able to get in the upper register and stay up there easier, had an easier time up there. And then because of the way Bill Evans comps and how sensitive Paul Motion was, you could hear him even though it's a lower action and very little amplification. I don't know if he was using a mic or not. I actually have an Amtec B15 that was made in the March of 61 that has Scott's name, has the name Scott on the tab. And supposedly the Amtec, you know, Everett Hall had made it for Scott, but I have not been able to confirm that. But I could have seen Scott, rather than doing what Oscar did and getting a cello in that, just plugging the upright in, you know, doing what Eddie Gomez and down the line, you know, did after him. But I find it interesting. Another big influence of Scott's was, and I finally confirmed this and it blew my mind, when I transcribed all of Scott's solos, I started sensing a Ray Brown influence. And when you listen to Scott play, you don't necessarily go, oh yeah, Ray Brown, right? But I started transcribing this stuff, and I was lucky to have a lesson with Ray Brown. And Ray focused on diminished and whole tone scales with me. He had, you know, this way of working through things with you know, those two scales. And I remember when I was transcribing Scott, I started seeing these patterns going, man, that kind of reminds me of what I ended up doing after my lesson with Ray Brown. And then I was going to call Ray up. I was always going to be in New York next month. I go, you know, talk to him. And then Ray, unfortunately, passed away. So I'm like, well, I'll never know. But then, years ago, I was in Copenhagen, and I had lunch with Ed Thigpen. I went over to Ed's apartment. And I said, Ed, man, I know this was like 4 million years ago, but do you ever remember Ray Brown mentioning Scott Bafaro or getting together with him or, you know, lessons or whatever? And he's like, oh, yeah, absolutely. I said, what? He said, yeah, I remember, distinctly remember being at a festival, and I hear two basses, and I open up the curtain, you know, this tent, you know, I put my head in the tent, and it was Ray Brown and Scott Bafaro bridge to bridge playing. And, you know, that had, you know, so I can hear that influence in Scott's playing as well. So I think Oscar kind of maybe gave him the bug that the bass can be more than just a, you know, a quarter note donkey, as I like to say, you know, just the ensemble timekeeper, and actually step out and make a real contribution to melody and soloing and harmony.
Okay. excuse me. This is Jose. I
I want you all to know that I have 5 songs that I can play here, and I was thinking of playing one. Would it be okay now?
Sure.
I want to play Sola from the famous Bill Evans Sunday at the Village Vanguard. Are you guys ready to listen?
Sure.
Can't wait.
All the listeners. Okay, I'm going to play it right now. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So that was Solar from the famous Bill Evans album, Sunday at the Village Vanguard, and it's a live album. Helene.
Yes,
Yeah, your book is I have to reassure the listeners to understand it's an autobiography.
Well, it's a biography of
give...
Scotty, not an autobiography.
It's not an autobiography.
About me.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. It's autobiography of Scott LaFaro. Is that correct, right?
Well, a biography of Scott LaFaro.
A biography. Well, can you tell us about his upbringing and you being the sister? And
I should say, get the book. that's what the publisher always tells us to say.
The book.
Yeah, right. You know, gotta push those book sales.
In general,
my dad was a musician, a child prodigy, and so there was just always music in the house. And my dad.
Your dad was what instrument did he play?
He was a violinist.
Oh, okay, so classical music.
Yeah, and he went to Ithaca, which at that time was a conservatory of music. He went there at age 12 and was there till he was 19. And by the time he and his classmates were going to be unleashed in the world, it had become a very big jazz scene in New York with the Dorsey Brothers and Paul Whiteman and all these guys. And so instead of following their classical roots, they all went down to the city to make careers for themselves. So my dad started out always with an interest in what was, coming up in music. And yet, he never did push Scotty and I towards music at all. Only when we expressed an interest did he, have us take lessons of that sort. And Scotty just had this natural ability with piano. And by the time he got to junior high, he was really became a reed player. He would play clarinet and tenor sax, and he truly intended to become a jazz saxophone player. And that was only cut short because he had an injury to his lip playing basketball. But when he went to college, my dad's alma mater, which was a college, they required that you take a string and a percussion besides your major instrument. And not knowing what to study, my dad said, well, if you take bass when you're home, you can play with my group because we don't have a bassist. My dad had a regular group in the local club. And so that's how Scott decided to play bass. And I think by the second month
he
was
away,
by the second month he was at Ithaca, he had fallen in love with the bass, gave his clarinet away. I don't know what happened to his saxophone, and he just became consumed with the bass. So that's how he got into that.
Interesting.
Did he ever consider going to the Eastman?
No, he and my dad would be at Eastman a lot for concerts, and my dad's roots were Ithaca College. And,
Sure.
And that's a family tradition. And my dad, really thought that was a fine place for him. I don't know if there were economic concerns at the time or not. I wasn't privy to that kind of that information. But I think that, Scotty just revered my dad so much. I remember a very poignant moment after my dad's funeral. On the wall at home, we had we had on the wall a bass and a violin and photographs and things. And Scotty just shook his head and said, I'm sorry, that Dad was the giant. He just really revered my father's knowledge. And what my dad said he should do, Scotty would do, that's for sure. I'm sorry for kind of losing it right there.
Okay,
but
it's okay.
But it was a very, very poignant moment.
Sure. Well, the interesting thing is, if he had attended the Eastman at that time, he would have probably overlapped with Ron Carter.
Sure.
And I could just see the Rochester scene, which is where I grew up, with both Ron Carter and Scott LaFaro on the scene at the same time. Whoa.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, Scott played more around Syracuse because it was closer to
Sure, yeah.
But you know, that's where Scott and my dad would be over at Eastman, because they would bring in Zoot Sims and all kinds of, you know, everybody who was, you know, doing concert tours at the time.
Right.
And so they spent a lot of time there, and I think Scotty's bass was bought one of the stores that was
right
at Eastman. And
yeah, you mentioned Levis Music.
Yeah, right.
Where
right.
I spent a whole lot of time,
right.
way too much time, when I should have been studying and stuff.
And at the time, and still do, have a whole Italian, all of our Italian
yes.
relatives are
oh,
still
yeah.
living
mm-hmm.
in Rochester and
yeah.
Fairport and around that area and
yeah.
things. So, you know, we have a lot of connections still with Rochester and things. But anyway, that Eastman kind of never, I don't think they ever discussed it. It was just, you know, my dad was from Ithaca, and, you know, that's where he suggested Scotty go, and
sure,
and that's the path he followed. Not that he stayed there that long,
right?
Actually, I have a question for Helene.
Yeah, Phil,
I'm going to become a third interview.
Is there something we haven't talked about yet?
Well, you know, I think there may be actually, and well, I don't know what to tell you. Tell the story first, or ask the question first. Okay, so the story is, so, you know, my bass teacher is from Syracuse, Tony Leonardi. And
uh-huh.
he talked, and I remember being over his house one time, and he had this 1955 Fender Precision, really old Fender. And I remember being at his place and playing it. At the time, I never played a Fender that old. And I asked him where he got it. He's like, oh, yeah, you know, there was this old blues band that used to play and, you know, somewhere in upstate. And Tony would hang there. And he's like, yeah, you know, I bought it off that bass player. Yeah, I used to go out and sit in with him all the time. And at some point, I bought it off him. And he's like, yeah, you know, I think about it. You know, Scott LaFaro used to come out to the club, and he'd sit in and play it, too.
And he would play the bass, because I have a lot of photographs in some casual shots. He was playing a lot of saxophone around the clubs then.
No, he would come in and play some electric bass, too. He'd sit on the electric bass with his blues.
I don't know about that.
Okay, well, my follow-up question was whether or not, you know, if he ever expressed an interest in the electric bass at all, because that was kind of a big thing, you know, in 55. And by
no, he never really did, and never, you know, because I think if he was truly interested, he would have gone out and bought one. But,
yeah,
you know, he was so focused in on what was currently in his head, you know,
yeah.
and he was a little frustrated. I think I mentioned that nobody was ever going to get that. And then he had tremendous excitement about working with Bill, because they really connected. They kind of got each other. You know, they were
right.
on different coasts but thinking of doing the same thing. And I think that even, you know, that the Vanguard recordings, I think he listened to them the day before he left town, you know, in July. And it's the first time he actually expressed that he was really, really happy with what he heard. Because
wow.
even all the other recordings, which, you know, to my untrained ear sounded perfectly fine, he was never satisfied with no matter what record it was or how good anyone else reviewed it. That's the only ones that he really thought, you know, by George, we've got it, you know. but, no, the electric guitar, I'm not, it's not something that we talked about, or he ever even mentioned. It's not to say that didn't happen, because I know he, you know, was pretty willing to you know, step in new directions.
Yeah, I suspect he would have got there at some point.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Interesting thoughts that could have been.
So let me bring up the issue of Arco versus pizzicato solos. There don't seem to be any recorded examples of Scott playing a bowed solo. Is that true?
Well, someone who really, didn't come to my mind right away, but Chuck Ralston, who is really knowledgeable on this told me that on the Ornette albums, on the C&D tracks, and I haven't listened to the Ornette album in quite a while. Now I will after I got this information that he's got some Arco both solos on the C&D track with on the recording Ornette.
Oh, okay.
So that's something that people, if they're not aware of and want to listen to, I'm going to listen to them this week because to say I haven't listened to those particular that particular album in a while. So it didn't come to my mind when you asked, but I passed that question by Chuck, and he's just such a font of knowledge about a lot of jazz, but Scotty in particular. He's my go-to guy.
Right. And Phil, could I ask, could you just maybe comment on, you know, the two ways of playing solos on a bass? I mean, that's unusual. I mean, there aren't two ways to play the trumpet, really, or the saxophone. But bass, you can solo in two distinctly different ways. Can you comment on, you know, sort of the history of that? I mean, Paul Chambers, of course, there are many recorded examples of him playing Arco solos. Can you just comment on that aspect of bass playing?
Sure. There are there's a couple factors to think of, consider. You know, Paul Chambers and some at that time, some people take bowed solos, you know, Slam Stewart and on down.
Sure.
Because, if you know, especially if you're playing a large ensemble, the bow will cut a little better. You know, cut through you can be heard a little better.
Sure.
But, you know, Scott playing with Paul and Bill, he was cutting fine because of the way that trio played.
Sure.
But I think that was probably less of a consideration with Scott. I mean, as a bass player, I know I have good bow chops. I studied classical. I used to play in an orchestra, and I've taken bowed solos. I think I have one or two recorded examples of me playing a bowed bass solo, but I just don't hear melodies that way. When I hear something in my head, I'm drawn to the pizzicato sound and what I can do with pizzicato chops. So I would suspect that, you know, that was this case with Scott, too. He was so, you know, when it came time to solo, even if he could, you know, out Paul Chambers, I think he probably still prefer his fingers because that's what he had in his head, would be my guess.
Okay.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you, do most jazz musicians study classical music first, or do they just jump right to jazz music? Do they have more of a knowledge of classical music?
Well, knowledge of classical music, I'm not sure, but you can study classical music without developing a vast repertoire. I mean, it's a technical aspect. You know, I studied classical, and I did indeed learn a lot about music and, you know, classical music, and I played in the Youngstown Symphony for about 5 years before I split town. But I hang out with, like, I have some friends in the Pittsburgh Symphony, and I hang out with those guys, and it's just their knowledge of classical music is insane. You know, I was never driven to learn as much as they did about it.
Right.
That said, I mean, the bass is such a physically demanding instrument. A lot of bass players study classical because, you know, like, for instance, left-hand position and intonation. When you're bowing a note, you can sustain the note, and you can really hear whether or not you're playing in tune, and you can all really focus on making a solid connection with your left hand. So I would gamble to say that most bass players study a certain amount of classical music just to get their left hand together, you know, and shifting, you know, intonation. You know, when you play jazz, if you just jump right into learning the upright bass and playing jazz, you can develop bad habits with your left hand. Your intonation may or may not be good. I'm sure there are some people out there that have done that and are just fine, but I usually recommend, I've known some young players where they just kind of pick, like, they're in high school and then they get into college and they're just playing jazz and they aren't doing any classical. And it seems to me, my advice always to them is, you're doing fine, but you might be able to get more music out of your head, you know, get to more of what you're hearing if your technique was a little better. And I don't think you're going to get your technique to where it could be if, you know, unless you study some classical style, classical technique.
Because, you know, when the big jazz movement was in the mid-40s, and most musicians that got involved in that, they were taking piano classes, you know, or any instrument, but they were taking it in a classical, learning a classical music. Now they were young. This music developed, and it was like a new, you know, it's a new generation, you know. So they switched over to playing jazz. It happened with Cachao, which you know who Cachao is, right? Me being Cuban. Cachao was, when he was 15 years old, he was playing in a classical orchestra, in a symphony. And right. And then they were, you know, 18, 19, well, he was 15 when he started. He wanted to, you know, it's a new thing coming out, and I'm young, and it's a new generation, and then they switched over. Nowadays, they're already, it's out there already, but that's why I asked the questions, because,
Well, actually, the interesting thing about, you know, when you mentioned that, you know, everybody studying classical, most universities didn't allow you to study jazz. They had no jazz program. They had no
exactly.
jazz teaching. Jazz teaching. If they heard you playing jazz in a hallway, you would have
right.
to see the dean. Like up into the 60s. I mean, I believe my bass teacher started the jazz program at Youngstown State in 1970. And a whole slew of people have come through since then. Sean Jones, Ralph LaLama, James Wideman. I mean, there's so many great, great players that come to that program. But 1970, you know. So, but you
yeah,
know,
there was no jazz program per se at Ithaca when Scotty went there. You just went to study music, and it was, you know, heavily based in, you know, symphonic music, which is, you know, Scotty in high school was with the orchestra, and they, you know, it was mainly the education was through the classical medium. At that time, I think Jazz Studies, University of North Texas, I think had the first actual major in jazz as a, you know, as a college major.
Of course.
And things that came a lot later.
Yeah. And ultimately, I mean, jazz is a vocabulary. So you could study, have a complete full functional degree in classical performance and then learn jazz, you know, study with a piano player, listen to the music. You know, that's why all those players were so great. Even though they didn't have a jazz program in their college, they learned their instruments really well and spent all night playing and listening to jazz, you know, to get the vocabulary together.
Mm. Well, and just listening. And Scotty, I think half of his whole life was listening, whether it was classical or jazz or anything. He would just, in those days, they had booths and record stores, and you could just go in and, you know, he would just stay in those for hours until they closed, listening to all sorts of things. He thought that's what people really needed to do, is listen. That was a big thing with him.
Yep,
since you mentioned that, let me get into a bit of a controversial area and ask, in the present way, the present system that jazz musicians are developed, which is, seems to me anyway, pretty much through academia, through jazz studies programs at universities. Could this system allow there to be another Scott LaFaro, for example, a real innovator? Because it seems to me that's what's lacking with a lot. Not you, Phil. Don't get me wrong, but. What I think that a lot of the young players today aren't doing is exactly what Helene said, and that is listening in the way that Scott did. I think that's possibly an element that's missing from today's players.
Well, yes, I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I don't know that's any different than what was probably happening in the 40s, 50s, and 60s either. You know, there was... I call it time compression. You kind of look back over 70 years, and it seems like there were just so many players and so many great things going on. But, you know, we don't see the moments when, you know, Scott was walking around in his, you know, jammies, you know, you know, eating a slice of pizza and prank calling Charlie Hayden or something. You know, who knows? But so today, I think the major difference between the two times, okay, so you got kids studying. there's not a lot of opportunity to sit down in a club with a band and play, you know, three sets a night, seven nights a week for a month. That, to me, so like the academic thing, I don't know, that's half dozen one, six of the other kind of thing. I don't know that that's an issue in negative or positive. To make a Scott LaFaro, what it takes is being on stage with people listening to you. And I've been lucky, like you mentioned me, I feel like I'm lucky that I've actually kind of caught a tail end of an era where I grew up and it was just a lot of live music, so I had a lot of opportunities to play on stage, but it still was nowhere near at the strength, you know, the time that when Scott was playing, where there was, like, and I love Helene's book where, she talked about, oh, yeah, you know, she interviewed somebody, says, oh, yeah, we had a gig in Chicago. And, like, okay, so I just had a gig in Detroit on Saturday night, right? My gig was, oh, I got a gig in Detroit, one night, you know, three sets, one night. Great gig, had a lot of fun. Scott has a gig in Chicago. It was seven nights a week for a month.
Sure.
That was the same in Los Angeles when he came out here. I mean, there were jazz clubs. We would go from one to the other. He might be playing, and then you go over to another one. And, you know, there was just this constant scene that people were always booked for 2 to 4 weeks at a time. Today, as Phil said, you're lucky if someone gets three nights in a row. Any place,
yeah.
Across, and so that, you know, that's not happening. And they all mix so much. They would, you know, afterwards they'd stay late and jam, and other people who came to listen would get up there and you know, sit in, and you know, kind of these things would go on all night. So they were learning so much from each other and having so much interaction, which isn't happening,
yeah.
Unfortunately today.
Yeah. Well, luckily there is that scene in New York City, at least, you know, where there's a lot of late night clubs, Smalls, Mesro, Fat Cat, you know.
Yes.
So it does, but it's not as much, you know.
But not
right.
In Los Angeles, even as large a city as this is, you know. It's, you know, maybe three jazz clubs, period. And there's nothing, you know, like there's just a show and nobody stays afterwards. And you know, they all
yeah.
pack and go home and things.
Yeah.
With a heavy cover, so young people can't. You know, you have,
yeah.
to have dinner and $35 cover. You don't get young kids who are, coming up. Don't go in to do that. You know, where it wasn't that way. You know, years ago.
Can I interrupt, Phil? Let me ask you: the jazz club owners. What kind
right.
of are they? Young? Are they old? In other words, do they want to hear the new stuff, or they want to hear more of the old stuff? Because I really don't understand why hard bop is not played. I mean, great music does not get old. You know what I mean? Why
is it
that
certainly.
nobody wants to play hard bop, and they all want to play
Miles
Davis?
There aren't that many clubs around anymore.
In New York City, hard bop is alive and well.
But
there's also a lot, you know, there's, absolutely. You know, that's like, I played a gig, I guess it was a couple months ago now with, you know, Eric Alexander, George Coleman, Harold Mayburn, and, Joe Farnsworth. And I just actually played with Eric and Vince Herring and Mayburn and Kenny Washington. And man, it was so great. And it was, the place
was
packed, you know, so it's still there.
It was
but,
packed. It was packed. And there were a lot of people listening in, there were a lot of people
the
there and there was an excitement.
So, it was great. And people, jazz is such a small segment of the population anyway, that people have their style of jazz. It's like, all right, so to go back. So hard bop was huge in the 50s and into the 60s. But technically, Scott and the Bill Evans Trio were kind of tearing that down. They were pushing ahead.
Right.
And
okay.
then, so now we're live now in 2015. And not only do we have to deal with hard bop, you have to deal with the 27 different styles of jazz that have happened since then,
yeah.
They all have their audience, you know. So, I mean, I've been lucky that I've been able to play a lot of different styles. I've played with the Vanguard Jazz Orchestra. I played down at Smoke with this Bill Mobley's band, which is like kind of it's more of a modern big band. I play at Birdland every Friday with Tommy Iger's big band, which is, play half that gig on electric bass, six string, you know, playing Got a Match and Michelle Camilo tunes alongside of, you know, Swingers. So as a musician, I like to do everything, you know, and I have to demand
okay.
living too.
There's right,
an audience
that's
for it all.
Okay, and that's
but,
New York. What other big cities you see a lot of jazz clubs? And in Europe, I mean, in Europe is more, I'm sure.
Yeah, Europe is. The interesting thing about, like, okay, so in America, there, you know, I find it funny that you wonder where Harbaugh is. I kind of feel like it's probably easier to tour in this country if you're playing a more traditional form of jazz. Whereas in Europe, they've really kind of, like, all those hard boppers who relocated to Denmark and Paris and that inspired a generation of Europeans, and then they went through their rings of, you know, different styles of jazz. And I feel like now they're doing things now that, like, there's one of my favorite piano trios in Europe was the EST, Estrin Svensson Trio. And they were playing jazz. It was jazz vocabulary, but it was kind of modern recording techniques. And you would listen to it and you go, yes, that's jazz. But okay. I don't want to say it was like a pop. It wasn't like a pop thing. It was just very modern. They weren't swinging. Like the rhythm was, there wasn't straight ahead swing on it, you know? And, but they had a huge audience. I've seen them at festivals and young people. And I kind of feel like that's what jazz needs to survive too, you know?
Sure.
So, you know, kind of pushing into modern songs. I just picked up Donny McCaslin's new CD. I'm an avid listener as well. I have a couple of stereos in the house, and it's my favorite thing to do. And so I'm always buying. I try to buy as much new stuff as old stuff. And Donny's CD is electric bass, Tim LaFave, one of my favorite electric players, and Mark Juliana. It's just really, really modern sounding, you know, record. I highly recommend you check it out to see kind of what's happening in New York right now, to hear how far hard bop has come, you know, what it's kind of spawned. I really think that that record is catching the vibe of what's happening in New York in 2015.
Right, but then you get to the I'm more traditional. Although I'm 57 years old, I'm more traditional. It gets to a point where you kind of go past the line, and it's not jazz. Is there? I mean, I know jazz is evolving, but when you start mixing, does it? Do you still hear that jazz? I mean, you hear that jazz when you hear this? Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Right. I just want to say I don't like to draw a line, though, because, you know, think about any year in history, and if we would have drew a line and said, okay, no, anything else past this is not jazz, we might have not ever heard Scott, you know.
Right.
I mean, talk about, like, you know, throwing down the role of the bass player. I mean, I still feel he's keeping the traditional playing in a busy two feel, and we can, you know, that's a totally geeky thing to geek out bass players talk about. But, you know, if he was forced to just be a timekeeper and walk quarter notes, the Vanguard sessions would never be here. You know, that sound would never be here. So,
Yes, you're right. You're right. But it's just like sometimes I hear this new. Go ahead.
Yeah. We'll hang out a couple nights in town. I'll drag you around town and scare you.
You got it. I just get that. I always question that because. It feels like they never heard the jazz from before, and they think this is new, and they don't realize that it has been evolving.
Oh, well, that is true. There's some young guys that come up with this thing, and it's like, I was talking with Miroslav Vitus about that, and I asked him, what is he listening to now? You know, of course, he's, you know, the Vanguard sessions were at the top of his list, and he talked about Duke Ellington and, you know, Cannonball and some people, but it was all things from the 60s, and I asked him, I said, well, what about current stuff? And he said, no, it's all derivative of stuff that's already been done. And I was like, well, that's interesting. You know, wow, okay. And then I have, you know, a couple of his newer records, and I see why he says that, because the stuff he's writing now really is an extension of stuff that hasn't been done yet. So, but he's right that a lot of people, I think they're coming up with something new. You know, at some level, we can analyze it and go, yes, it's already been done and it's derivative, but it's still good music.
Yeah. Sure.
And let me ask you one last question. What effect has, I don't even know what they call it, jazz music, smooth jazz has had on jazz and it's evolving? I think it has stopped it from evolving. It's more like the music industry selling records. I don't know. What effect has it had? On jazz? The smooth jazz, which you shouldn't call
way,
smooth jazz. I mean, you should just call it smooth music. You know what I mean?
Right, or light rock or something. Yeah, I mean, it's
right.
In some way, it's had a good effect, in that people go, they hear the word jazz and it's associated with something that they actually might like instead of something they think they're going to hate. You know, there's so many people. I play with a piano trio called Tri-Fi, and we play jazz. It's piano trio, and it's, I don't know, it's people hear this trio, and there's so many people that come up to us after and go, wow, I really hate jazz, but I like you guys. And I always go, surprise, you like jazz. So I think if there's somebody out there that loves smooth jazz, they might actually take the chance and walk into a jazz club and hear a hard bop set and go, oh, no, this is great. You know, maybe their first experience with hard bop was some really crappy quintet in the middle of nowhere that really wasn't that good. And I'm like, oh, I hate all jazz. But then they come somewhere and they hear, you know, George Coleman and Mayburn playing, and they go, wow, no, I like this. So I think if there's people out there that like
the opportunity.
Jazz, yeah.
I also think that most people that listen to smooth jazz really don't listen to music. They don't have experience, let's put it that way. Or listen to all different types of music and all, you know, traditional music and things. And so they just pick up on that right away. But the word jazz is in there, and they think that's just my opinion.
Yeah. Well,
but like you said, it gives them the opportunity. Yeah.
Well, that's what I think, you know, that might be the value, is that people who absolutely maybe never heard jazz and just decide they don't like it, they don't understand it. Sometimes when they've heard smooth jazz, they sort of think, well, okay, I like that. Maybe I will go to that club and hear it. And they might be just blown away because it won't be anything like smooth jazz. It'll be, you know, something like Phil and Don Friedman play. And then suddenly, having never heard it, sometimes they can pick up on it and start to enjoy it and understand it more. So sometimes it's just like a little gateway because it has that word jazz and just smooth, and that, you know, even if that's all that they were, you know, they were dipping their toe in, and has opened the doors to some people to be more open to listen to it instead of just closing their mind, you know, to jazz entirely.
But what about a musician who wants, who's, you know, a young kid, 18 years old, learning, and he wants to play jazz, and he learns to, you know, the instrument, and he knows all about jazz and can play it, but then he has to play smooth jazz to get known. I think it's tough on them. It's tough on them because.
Well, it depends. I mean, like our drummer, I was just talking with our drummer, and, you know, he kind of came into jazz. He was our heavy metal drummer. And then he discovered the Rippingtons and Spyro Gyro and David Sanborn, who were probably like,
right.
You know, that smooth jazz, like, kind of came out of those guys. That was fusion and, like, real high-level playing, and it kind of turned into a light pop thing afterwards. But that, you know, and now he's, you know, he studied with Billy Hart and became this amazing, you know, jazz drummer, you know, so... I think people find their own paths. You know, if they really like smooth jazz, and they decide to stay with that, you know, it's a great way to put, you know, put food on the table if there's an audience and that's who you are.
No, I've been, you know, really surprised over the years of rock and roll guys and heavy metal guys who know who are, you know, basically electric jazz bass players.
Oh yeah,
know who Scotty is and. You know, Eric Clapton.
Okay.
Told me, you know, he was a hero of his. You know, I mean, there's people that, you know, do venture farther than what it is they're doing, and sometimes surprisingly so, because, you know, some of these guys have got things that I would never consider listening to. There's a group, I think it's in Ireland, called Scott LaFaro, and I said, where did they get that name? And they used to listen to his records in the record store they worked at, and I have to tell you, I had a hard time listening to even one track of what they're currently doing.
I
wasn't surprised to find out they even knew who Scotty was, let alone name their group after him. That was kind of a surprise.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm trying to say. But you know, Phil's out there. He knows. There's a chance that we'll give back. Because things go around in a cycle. I'm hoping it comes back.
Well, there's still people doing it, man. You know, there's still, you got to check out like Eric Alexander and Vince Herring. They're still playing hard bop and they're doing it at the height. You know, I mean, they're great and they have their audience and that's who they are, you know, and it's
right.
Just, they're awesome, you know, so it's still there, you know, it's probably stronger than it ever used to be. I mean, I know that, you know, a lot of these guys now when they play festivals, they're making money, you know, and there's hundreds of thousands of people that'll come to, you know, a major festival. And you know, in Europe or something, and part of that is going to be hard bop players and people go out to hear him and they like him. And I remember seeing Johnny Griffin play to a packed house in Amsterdam at the what is that, Norsche, and you know, thousands of people screaming. So, you know, but it's luckily we're in a day and age where you could do that. Then you could turn around and go hear Soundgarden, you know, or some heavy metal band if you like that. You know, it's, as far as I'm concerned, as long as there's live music, I don't care what it is. I just want people to go out and support something.
I might mention somebody else in New York City, well, at least part of the time in New York City, Chris Byers, a very fine saxophonist.
Oh, yeah, I know Chris really well.
Yeah, plays in the tradition, you know, that you like, Jose. But also he writes, and the tunes are, you know, not conventional. They have twists and turns and things like that. So it's in the pocket, but it's also, you know, moving things out a little bit. So, yeah, I mean, things are never going to stay the same. You know, I certainly agree with you, you know, I mean, because that's the music that I grew up with, you know, and so... I tend to think that the music you grew up with is the stuff that sticks with you for the longest period of time. But I also realize that nothing stays the same. And furthermore, it's so important, as Phil has pointed out, that musicians nowadays be versatile. Because if you're not versatile, you can't work.
Right.
You've got to play all kinds of different musics.
Yeah, I'm not a musician, but from listening to his music, it's completely different. The bass is ahead, you know, in front, and it's not just in the background. It's who knows?
He was put on that Coleman. No, I was just saying, and then you hear Scott playing on a Hampton Hawes record for real.
Yeah.
He's right, you know, playing down the middle, you know. There's a great Hampton Hawes record called For Real.
Right.
I wonder if he would have entered the, and I'm sure he would have entered the jazz fusion era, you know. And what effect he had on the jazz fusion bass players.
Quite possible. I mean, certainly.
He was way ahead,
through the channels.
Okay, Helene, can you tell us how we can the listeners can pick up this book?
Well, it's available on Amazon. How easy is that?
Right. Yeah, I put a link there on the home.
I know you know local bookstores will order it for you, but it's always available on Amazon. I think paperback mainly now. I don't know if they have any hardback left, but. It's been on there since the fall of 2009, and so if anyone is interested, they certainly could just go online.
Excellent book.
I'll link that. Also, it's very important to say it's available in Kindle because a lot of people read
books.
It is
available. I never think of that. I'm still a person who likes the tactile touch of books.
Yeah.
Even though my kids have gotten me the Kindle things, I just can't get with all that electronics yet. But yes, it is.
This
and in Japanese, if you want to. If you're,
yes, in Japanese, too.
You can read Japanese.
Translated.
But not locally. I think you have to go to Japan to get that.
But this book is interesting because it has not just the biographical part, but also these sections, one of which Phil wrote, another one by Jeff Campbell.
Right.
And other people also talking about the bass and the music and so forth. And there's even a section on restoring the bass, the Scott LaFaro bass that was damaged in the fatal accident,
right,
which was fascinating. Where is that bass now?
Well, that bass just recently at the International Society of Bassists Convention in Colorado in June was given to the International Society of Bassists to curate that going forward so that people can use it for concerts and recordings. Phil has recorded with the bass. I think Mark Johnson has also recorded.
Mm-hmm.
It will be now at Ithaca College in Ithaca.
Oh, okay.
Where his archives will be. We're hoping to have his archives established there by 2017, where the next bass convention will be. And hopefully that all will come together by that time.
Great.
Yeah, there's...
Phil has played the bass several times.
Yeah, that's I didn't know that. Phil, you have a website, of course, for your music, philpalambi.com. And
yes,
there's an article here. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. I was just going to spell my name, P-A-L-O-M-B.
I know.
Yeah. For the,
what if I say, like, in Spanish, Palombi? It sounds better.
Exactly. No, that's it.
And you have the return of LaFaro's bass to the Village Vanguard. Now, this was written in July, but... can you tell us about that? And did he make an event out of it, or...?
Yeah, it was a bit of an event. I mean, I was trying to, I should back up. Helene was nice enough to introduce me to Barry Kohlstein, who was the curator of the bass. His father restored the bass for Scotty back in 1957. And
I got to step in there. Actually, Barry did most of the restoration because his dad just could hardly get himself to do it because of the emotionality of his connection with Scott. And so Barry did most of the restoration.
Oh, right, in the 80s. I was thinking Sam, his father and Scott were really close. Scott didn't like the bass at first, apparently, in the 50s.
Right.
And so Sam restored the bass for Scotty in 57, and then after the accident, years later, like Helene said, Sam could never bring himself to do anything, but before Sam passed away, Barry said, "Dad, it's time to do this." And it was, the 25th anniversary?
Yeah.
At the convention that they got together and they restored the instrument. And Barry was able to save the body of the instrument. He had to carve a new scroll and a new neck, but was able to save the body and preserve the work that Barry's father, Sam, had did for Scott, which really kind of made it the instrument it is. But the problem is it hasn't been played hardly at all in, the decades since. And I was lucky in 2010 to have it for a couple weeks, and they let me take it home, and I played it in the house for about 2 weeks and did a recording with Don Freeman and Elliot Zygma. I did a tribute to Scott LaFaro and used the bass then. And it sounded great and actually changed my life because the instrument speaks so well and plays so evenly and it's so easy to play that I realized that, wow, I can play anything on a bass. Now I need to learn a little bit more about what I should be playing. I think Scott had a similar situation where when the instrument gets out of your way, you can really focus on music. And then I had it again the following year for the CD release. I played it 2 nights at the Katana with Don and Elliot. And then had it, years went by, and I had this idea that I knew it was getting dedicated, and I thought, well, I'd do another record with it before it leaves the New York area. And this time I was able to bring it home for about 6 months. And so I was also, the insurance situation was a little more secure, and I was able to take it on gigs. Like, I called Madeline up at the ISB, the International Society of Bassists, and said, "Can I take this to it?" And he's like, "Yeah, take it and play it." And that's when that instrument really changed. So if you can imagine starting in, January, the end of January, taking it to my steady gig at the Plaza Hotel, taking it in the Birdland every Friday. I was recording jingles. There's a L'Oreal commercial in Europe that I've tracked at that bass. And, some other jingles, some FedEx commercials I used for it, tracking jingles.
Oh, yeah.
I did a bunch of other, there's a couple vocalists I worked with. I used it on their records. I just took it. And, of course, I did a record. I went in the studio 4 days with it in May. But, yeah, also in May, I was trying to work it out so I could get a night at the Vanguard and bring Don and Elliot in and do a tribute to Scotty, and I just could not work that out. But, you know, I play with the Vanguard Jazz Orchestra quite a bit. And so John Mosca called me up and said, hey, why don't you do the next 2 weeks? And so I brought his bass down and kind of, you know, give his, you know, featured in that sense that, you know, John said, and told everybody in the club, we have a special guest here tonight, you know, Scott's bass. And yeah, the reaction from the crowd was incredible. And to do that 2 weeks in a row was really special. But most importantly, at that point, I'd been carting that bass on subways, buses, my car. And people were always saying, aren't you afraid of, you know, taking it out? I'm like, no, I take my bass everywhere. Well, that, you know, it's a bass. It's going to be fine. But I think rolling it on wheels through the New York City subways, down the sidewalks, retracing all of Scotty's steps, helped that bass open up in a way that just playing it wouldn't have. And by the time I got to the Vanguard with it, I made sure especially the first time I walked in, I got there an hour early when nobody was there, and just set up on stage and, you know, didn't plug anything, just played it acoustically on stage and got chills. It, all of a sudden, it was the exact sound of that, you know, the Vanguard sessions. You know, I was geeking out and playing all my LaFaro licks and, you know, solo stuff I've memorized, and just, it was surreal to be playing that instrument on that stage. I feel like it finally came back to life, like the rhythm of life, the rhythm of having people around it constantly and being taken places.
Oh yeah, and it needs to be played.
Yeah.
You know. Hopefully going forward it'll get played, a lot more things.
And then flying out, you know, I brought it out to the convention in Colorado, and that's the only time I was really concerned where I had to put it in a flight case and check it in. But Southwest Airlines with, you know, the most amazing people. They're really, really, like, incredibly bass friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt great with flying it out there with them. They were awesome. And having it up to test the product performed with it, which, Helene, I don't know if I told you, actually, we're going to release that concert as a live record.
Oh, good.
So I'll be talking to you about that, with, you know, getting a quote from you or something for the live record.
Yeah.
That would be after the show.
Very good.
I would love that. But, yeah, I missed that instrument. Luckily, Barry Kohlstein made a copy of the bass for me. So I at least have a clone of that instrument. Scotty's bass is Scotty's bass, and it's time, you know, I have my bass. So as great as it was having Scotty's bass for 6 months, I feel like, you know, I need Phil's bass now. But the dimensions of the instrument and the sound, you know, they're so similar, yet I could get, you know, a different thing out of it. Just couldn't be happier, you know, to have access to a copy of the instrument now.
Very, very good. Is that the size, the travel size or the regular?
Oh, it's the regular. It's a, you know,
do you have a travel size, the travel one too, the Jess?
Oh, yeah, he gave me the travel base too, the little Bassetto base. Yeah, so Barry Kohlstein made up for traveling a copy of Scott's base, but it's really narrow and thin, and the neck comes off of it, so you can check it, you know, check the body as baggage and carry the neck on a plane.
Yeah.
And, you know, that thing sounds amazing too. Actually, I use that at Birdland every Friday now, so I keep it broken in town, and it's a little easier to take on a train. Because I got to take an electric bass down for that gig too. But yeah, Barry's a special guy. He's an amazing luthier, and I could see why Scott and Sam got together. You know, I think Sam, when he restored that instrument for Scotty, and
right.
Scott's like, I want a lower action, and you know, actually, you know what? I'm not even going to talk about it. Go to my YouTube page. Which is youtube.com/bassphil, BASSPHIL. And I have about an hour interview of Barry talking about the whole history of the bass.
Also
a big chapter. Yeah, yeah. But he also, you know, you have to get Helene's book. I can't emphasize that enough.
Of course.
Barry wrote a chapter, you know, got more detailed about the actual restoration of it, you know. And, you know, the book is more than a story about Scott. I mean, if you're a horn player, you want to read this book because it's just a history of jazz as well and what the scene was like. And, you know, a life of a jazz musician, you know. So I think it's a very important book to read. So you can check out Barry talking about a little bit more about the history of bass on my YouTube page. I have some videos of me playing Scotty's bass up there, too.
What's your YouTube link? Can you tell all the listeners? And I'm writing it down here.
It is youtube.com/bassphil. B as in boy, A-S-S-P as in Paul, H-I-L, Bassville. Or if you go to my website. And you get there's a link to my YouTube page. I have a couple of videos on my website, but then there's a link to the actual YouTube page where all my videos are. So I have videos of me playing Scotty's bass with Don Friedman and the Tri-Fi and solo and everything.
And that interview that you were mentioning, where can that be found? On that YouTube page?
Yes, it's on the YouTube page, yeah.
Okay.
But if you probably do a Google search for Barry Colstein interview Scott LaFaro's bass, you'll come to it.
Yeah, I was doing that. I was also looking at the International Society of Bassists. Right. Helene, you did some work with them, right?
Well, I've always been very close with them because the family does do a jazz award at their convention, and they've just helped me immeasurably over the years in getting the book together and getting finding a publisher for it and all sorts of things
Okay, yeah. I'm looking here on a page on Scott LaFaro. There's also, just curious, the painting there by Manny Fernandez. Is any connection with you?
Well, that's my husband, the Cuban artist.
Okay. Oh, he's Cuban. Okay.
Are you?
Yes, I'm Cuban, yes.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. And, yes, my husband did that.
I knew there was some kind of connection here.
Yeah, he did that painting for one of the for a poster for one of the base conventions a few years back, and so I think Phil, we have that's on the front of your book too, isn't it?
Yes, that's the cover of my transcription book. Is that
right?
And I think you could still buy the print of that painting, and the proceeds go to the Scott LaFaro Scholarship Fund, right?
Right. You can buy that through the International Society of Bassists. They have a store online where you can get Jade Visions.
Yeah.
You can buy the CD Jade Visions.
That might
you can buy the poster, and then the funds go to the scholarship as well. And I'm lucky enough to have the original, both the paint and the artist.
Okay. All right. And that's great to know. All right. You want to continue on here, or you think we covered everything? You want to? No. Would you like to ask us? You have something else specifically to ask here?
No, I think I've. It's been great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if you think of anything else, you know where to find us.
Yeah.
Exactly. We didn't get to as much music here, though.
I can play more after. I don't want to keep you guys on the line.
Right, you can always put it in, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can continue with it. No. I thank you very much, both you, Helene, and Phil, for the interview. And this interview here, just for the listeners, is being recorded right now live, and it will be available 5 minutes afterwards. You can either go to the link itself, the show page link on blogtalkradio.com, or you can go to jazzcoonclass.com, which is my jazz station. And I'm sure as soon as I find out anybody else who's posted the show, I'll put it out there so people can
okay.
hear it.
Well, it's been a fun experience. Thank you so much, Phil, for joining us.
All right. Thank you for having me. It's great to talk to you all. It's great to talk to you again, Helene. I'm going to be in L.A. in January, I think, so I'll look you up.
Oh, my goodness. You'll be here for my birthday. All right.
All right. We'll talk. I'll bring something. I'll bring wine.
Okay. We'll be in touch before that. But nice to talk
Absolutely.
To everybody.
Okay. Bye. Bye, everybody.
Good night.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good night.
Okay. Bye.
Good night. Okay, good night. Bye-bye. Oh, no.
Yes.
I'm going to both here on right now. You want me to play? I guess I would just end the show with Jade Visions.
Sure.
The song which is named after the
book.
Right.
Yeah, just do that. Yeah, that's fine.
You have any final thoughts?
No, I mean, I'm you know... I think they both said
a
lot of very
there.
Interesting and informative things, so I think it went very well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So, okay. Thank you, Noel, and
sure.
Thank you, all the listeners, for joining us. And I'm gonna leave. I'm gonna finish the show here with a song from the famous Bill Evans "Sunday at the Village Vanguard" live album from 1961. And the name of the song is the same name as the book, Jade Visions. Okay, thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, listeners, thank you very much for joining us. And until next time, thank you. Bye-bye.